Hello, I'm Michael Serapio, and this is the Primetime Politics Podcast.
Tonight on Primetime Politics, a policy reversal in BC, a heated debate in Ottawa.
What the hell are they thinking over there?
The Conservative leader pushes the Trudeau government to kill a BC pilot program. It decriminalizes some illicit drugs to get more people into care, but has also led to widespread public drug use. MPs will debate the merits of the program. Also,
we would use it very sparingly.
The Alberta Premier defends her bill to increase provincial oversight of municipal affairs. Coming up, we'll speak with the Mayor of Calgary, who says this is unnecessary overreach. And bad news for the governing Liberals as polls show their budget is failing to impress Canadians. This is Primetime Politics. Hello, everyone. I'm Michael Serapio. British Columbia's pilot program to decriminalize some illicit drugs was front and center in Parliament today. BC wanting to roll back provisions that allow for public drug use, but the federal government, which needs to be involved, has not taken what Conservatives describe as immediate action. The official opposition did ask for an emergency debate on the issue. It was denied by the Speaker. So now Conservatives are demanding the government allow for a take-note debate.
Worse than refusing to take immediate action, the government has refused to rule out expanding this dangerous and extreme pilot project to other communities, most notably in Toronto. So they're refusing to rule out expanding this deadly policy to other communities in Canada. And that is why Conservatives believe that the Trudeau government needs to be held accountable to parliamentarians and are calling on the government to grant this emergency take note debate immediately so that Canadians can hold this government accountable.
Joining us now are Brendan Hanley, Liberal MP for Yukon, Layla Goodridge, the Conservative critic for addictions, and Gord Johns, who is the NDP critic for mental health and harm reduction. Hello to the three of you. Listen, Layla, I'll get you to start us off here, because it's your party that's calling for this take-note debate. You know, why not just give the government time to react to BC's request? That meeting took place the end of last week. Why not give this a bit more time?
Well, frankly, it's been a year of a pilot project in British Columbia that we've had some very devastating responses coming out of. A couple weeks ago in Health Committee, we heard very clearly from Fiona Wilson, the Deputy Police Commissioner, that they did not have the tools they needed to be able to deal with the addiction crisis and support communities and community safety. And this is incumbent on them. British Columbia has already tried to bring forward their own legislation, have had it now caught up in the courts. And so they're asking the federal government to bail them out, and the federal government taking their time waiting and forcing more Canadians to die, this drugs and disorder to continue is absolutely not acceptable, and they deserve to answer directly to Canadians as to why they're delaying.
Okay, Brendan, let's pick up Layla's point there, because, you know, it is true. The BC government did try to put their own limits on this. It's backed up in the courts. And the province is now asking for Ottawa to provide this exemption. And the nurses union in BC say it's necessary. They say that their patients are in danger. Why hasn't there been more immediate action?
Well, you know, when an exemption request came just at the end of the week, the ministry obviously has to consider that request, and I'll really leave that for the ministry to follow due process and consideration of Premier Eby's request. What I will say, though, is that there are really two issues here. One is the concept and the practice of decriminalization and allowing time for a pilot to take place, and the other is about public consumption of drugs and the public nuisance aspects of consumption in public places. And we have to be careful not to confound those two. Clearly, there's a relationship, but many of the problems that were identified and are very real problems are not inherently problems of decriminalization itself. So we need to, you know, there are nuances here. We need to take some time to really consider this carefully.
Okay, nuances, I take what you're saying, but, you know, one does come from the other. So when will there be action? Because, you know, nuisance is the word that you use. Public safety is the terminology being used on the ground.
So we've just come from committee, all three of us were in committee hearing further testimony on a number of aspects of this terrible crisis. What is real is that 21 Canadians are dying a day, seven a day in BC. This is a critical problem. We have to address this in the interests of Canadians and lives of Canadians and the safety of the community at the same time.
Gord, I'm wondering what your take is on this. How well has this pilot program gone when drugs are being consumed in public spaces? You have a union saying that they can't do their job, people talking about feeling a sense of danger. How well has this program gone?
Well, I think first we can look at the numbers themselves. I mean, we've seen an increase in toxic drug deaths in British Columbia go up 5%. In neighboring Alberta, they're up 17%. In Saskatchewan, 23%. Over in Alaska, just north of us, it's gone up 45% year over year. Those are provinces and states without harm reduction, without safer supply programs or decriminalization. I think we need to push the jurisdiction aside and pull the politics apart and look at evidence-based policy and best practices. And we heard from Fiona Wilson, the chiefs of police for British Columbia, and she was unequivocally clear that going back to criminalizing people is not what they support. They see a health-based response to this crisis. They also were unequivocally clear that diversion of safe supply, despite the Conservatives spreading that disinformation, is not what's killing people. It's deadly fentanyl. They called for more safe consumption sites, more affordable housing, scaling up and ramping up treatment on demand, recovery, prevention, education, things that the NDP has been calling for and was identified in my bill C-3210 to have a health-based response to the toxic drug crisis. So I think we need to evaluate each policy and look at it in a whole context. But right now, I mean, any increase in deaths isn't good. And my heart goes out to the families, and we need to do everything we can to stop an increase in deaths. But we also need to make sure we're listening to evidence-based policy, not ideology.
Okay, Leila, let's pick up on that. You know, is there not some merit in a program, you know, taking some time to get it right, but a program that is, by many accounts, saving lives? Because, you know, BC is not throwing the whole program away. What they're asking for here is tweaks.
They're not asking for a wholesale change. This is a massive change that they're asking for that the federal government has yet to say whether they will even entertain. So I think that that's an important factor to push out there. And so people in BC woke up on Saturday thinking that public drug use was now going to be illegal again. And surprise, it's not. You can still do everything that has been done before. We've heard horrific cases of public drug use in hospitals, putting people's lives at risk, putting patients' lives at risk, putting nurses' lives at risk. There was a young nurse who was the mom of twin girls who stopped breastfeeding her child because she was subjected to so much toxic illicit drug fumes in the workplace that she didn't think that that was going to be safe to continue breastfeeding her child. As a mom of young children, I can't imagine being put into that situation by my workplace because my government put forward a policy that it was not ready to put forward, that was absolutely broken and is putting this many people at risk. So I reject the fact that this is a small change that the government is asking for. They're basically asking the federal government to bail them out of the mess that they asked for.
You know, Gord, you know, we all only have one opportunity to make a first impression. And I'm wondering if this pilot has gone badly enough, because there are a number of critics, that it can actually be recovered and saved.
Absolutely. I mean, we heard loud and clear from the BC chiefs of police that they wanted more tools to be able to move people along in extraordinary cases, they would criminally charge them. But they were unequivocally clear that they don't want to go back to criminalizing people who use substances. It causes more harm and it doesn't work. So I think we can look at what the police have been saying and other experts, and we need to ramp up our response in everything from treatment on demand, recovery, prevention, education, and yes, safer supply. The liberal approach has been incremental. which is, cost lives in a health crisis. The conservatives spread disinformation, and that's deadly in a health crisis. What we need is the government to act like it's an emergency. They haven't declared a health emergency. They haven't had a summit on this crisis like they did on the auto theft summit, despite the fact that this is the leading cause of death for people under the age of 59 in my home province. And they haven't reinstated the expert task force, which they responded to my call in question period today that they would. But they need to act like it's a health emergency. They've spent less than 1% in responding to this crisis than they did COVID-19. And it's because of stigma, purely because of stigma.
Okay, Brendan, obviously you yourself noted that there are at least a couple of things going here. One has to do with the public drug use. The other has to do with the theory of trying to decriminalize drugs for better health outcomes. A lot of issues which, quite frankly, a take note debate might be able to clarify it for Canadians. Will your government answer the Conservative call and let a take note debate happen?
Personally, I don't have a problem with having a debate. What I want is for the public to be as well informed about this crisis as possible, and to know how this involves almost every family in the country is affected in one way or another. I come from a small jurisdiction, the Yukon, of course. We only have 40,000 communities. We have an unacceptable rate of death. We have to look at all options to address this crisis using the broader four pillars. And we have to learn from our experiences. We have not doing anything, leaving the status quo of criminalizing drug use is wrong and has been and is a risk in itself. So, we have to learn where we have unexpected consequences, readjust, and one jurisdiction, one community learning from another. So that's the way ahead. I'd be happy to participate in any level of debate, whether that's in the House or at committee level.
Okay, you are, but will you press your government to do that? Because Conservatives are pressing your government to actually have this take note debate.
I think again, the ministry has taken the request from Premier Ubeda, and the minister will be considering that request. And
not the BC request, but the take note debate being called upon. The Conservatives are calling on your government to bring about.
This has been a crisis since 2016. So whether and in fact, it was the year before last that I called on the House to have a take note debate on the opioid crisis, and we had I think there is time to reconsider that. Whether that's this week or next week, we need to keep these discussions going. This is why I brought the study to this committee. To figure out the best course ahead to address this very complex, very distressing crisis in all its aspects.
Okay, Leila, I have about a minute left, so I'm going to give the last word to you because, again, your party's calling for this. Why do you think this take note debate is important?
It's absolutely crucial for Canadians to hear very clearly where this is at. It's funny that Brendan says that he supports this. I brought forward a motion at our health committee to have the Minister of Mental Health and Addiction as well as British Columbia's Minister of Mental Health and Addiction come to our committee to talk about this very issue, and they voted, the NDP Liberal Coalition voted to shut down the debate on this and not to have that vote because they don't want Canadians to hear. And so Conservatives are going to continue pushing. We need to have these conversations. We need to have this debate in the House of Commons because Canadians deserve to have these answers. We're hearing horrific, gruesome stories coming out of British Columbia from the absolute chaos and crime that is on the streets because of pure public disorder in the drug use. This is not about stigma. This is about, it has become a Wild West of everything goes because we have not had the tools in place to actually have something put that is actually logical. And this is a serious problem. And Canadians are demanding answers. And what makes matters even worse is the Minister of Mental Health and Addiction stood in the chamber today and refused to say that she wouldn't go forward with Toronto's request to do this. So we have one jurisdiction saying, whoa, this is a bit of a failure. We need some help. Bail us out. And the federal government is saying, but we're still going to go down and look at the request coming from Toronto. It's a completely different situation. Well, it doesn't make sense. This absolutely doesn't make sense, and this is just indicative of what this government has done on this file, where they try and distract Canadians and push them away from what the real topic is. And Canadians are brilliant, and they understand that this is an absolute crisis. This is a public health crisis, and we need to deal with it as such, and we need to prioritize treatment and recovery, and Conservatives will do exactly that. We have been pushing forward our message on treatment and recovery, and we'll continue doing so because Canadians deserve to know that their government will stand up for them, and we believe that they can recover. People do recover.
Okay, and I apologize, we're out of time, but obviously the request for this Take Note debate happened late today, so we'll follow it as the week goes on. Brendan Hanley, Leila Goodrich, Gord Johns, thank you very much for the time this evening.
Thank you very much.
To Calgary now, where the Alberta Premier defended her government's recently introduced Bill 20. When passed, it will allow for the creation of political parties at the local level in Edmonton and Calgary. It will see the return of union and corporate donations to political candidates. And it would give the provincial government the power to remove city councillors and the power to overturn bylaws and postpone elections. Take a listen to what Danielle Smith had to say about Bill 20 today.
This is something that everyone was asking for at one point about 18 months ago. There is also a need as well, I think, to give some clarity around the fact that we intend to defend our jurisdiction.
Well, to talk about Alberta's Bill 20, we're now joined by the Mayor of Calgary, Jody Gondek. Mayor Gondek, good to see you again. Thank you for being here.
Thanks so much for having me on.
So listen, your predecessor, Nahed Nenshi, he calls this bill an act of spite, saying that the Smith government is doing this, quote, out of revenge on the voters of Calgary and Edmonton who did not vote the way they wanted them to. And, you know, to be clear, Mr. Nenshi is running to lead the provincial NDP now, but do you share his assessment? Do you see this bill as an act of spite?
I see this bill as an incredible act of overreach and yet another example of the desire for control and power by this provincial government, who should actively be working with municipalities to help us take care of the citizens that we commonly serve. And instead, it's one thing after another where they want to dominate and control municipalities.
Okay, an act of overreach, although to hear it from the government and the Minister of Municipal Affairs, they essentially say this bill is about making sure that there is transparency, making sure that there's accountability for council, that elections are fair. And municipalities are entities of the province. Do they not have the right to oversee civic affairs?
Municipalities are already under the oversight of the provincial government. There's many measures that are laid out in Bill 20 that they already have the power to do. They have the ability through the minister to remove a member of council if there is some sort of conduct that deserves it. We've seen it happen in a neighboring municipality. So if you already have this power, why the overreach? It's kind of, I don't have any good words for it, because it's staggering, the amount of power they want to have. And yet this is a government that created a bill about a sovereignty movement. And so if you want sovereignty so badly and you don't want overreach from the federal government, then you should probably think about exactly what you're doing to municipalities.
Well, you know, we have heard Danielle Smith earlier say that local councils have made choices that are looking to be more, and these are basically her insinuations, more partisan, more ideological. And she says that requires more transparency. You know, has your office or council failed to be transparent enough, do you think?
Absolutely not. We have been transparent with the public. We've been transparent with the provincial government. We've been transparent with the federal government when they've asked for things. So this is simply an exercise in exerting power and flexing their muscle. And I don't know why they need to do it. They already are the parent of municipalities. We are creatures of the province. And so if, you know, you wanted to make a statement that you have power over us, you already do. This bill is not needed.
So Is this the, you keep saying you don't know why. I'm wondering, since it's been announced last week, what are the reasons that come up to your mind? Is this an ideological push? Again, Calgary, for example, in the last provincial election, at one point looked like it might be going NDP. Do you see that as part of the equation here?
It might be. I mean, the thing that I struggle with is the use of language, like being able to remove members of council if it's in the public interest. Yet public interest is not defined. And, you know, these conversations about how things have to align with provincial priorities, to me, that sounds incredibly ideological from a government who is saying they want to prevent ideology. It's actually pretty rich. At a municipal level, we don't run on a party system. I have no party leanings. I don't belong to any of the parties provincially or federally because I believe strongly that my job is to serve locally. And if you start chipping away at that by introducing a measure where the two biggest cities are now going to have to be faced with a party system, you're actually eroding our ability to work with other orders of government and really deliver value to the people that we serve.
Okay, let me pick up on that point then. And for people who don't know, part of this bill does allow the creation of political parties at the local level. You say that will impede the work that you do. How does it actually do that?
Well, first of all, we don't know what this even looks like because the only language that we've seen is consider regulations around creating parties as a pilot project in both Edmonton and Calgary, the two biggest municipalities. So you're covering a huge swath of the population and you're making candidates have to determine whether they're going to start a party or join a party. I don't know. They haven't defined it for us. And so if you really want to take away the ability for municipalities to make good, strong decisions on behalf of the people, you implement something like this.
Now, this bill does come after an earlier bill that would allow the provincial government to, as you know, veto any deal struck between Ottawa and entities of the province like municipalities. Do you think both of these measures are essentially trying to create a united front against Ottawa? Is this what's motivating it?
I mean, if you want to create a united front against Ottawa, they could have just, you know, spoken with us. I can tell you that mayors from across this country were not happy with the federal government because we weren't receiving enough infrastructure funding. We continue to be frustrated by both orders of government, frankly, not understanding that the income taxes that are paid by our people in our cities need to flow back to us so we can provide them with the services that they need. So, you know, I don't have a problem forming a united front to get more from the orders of government that serve us, but this is certainly not the way to do it.
Now, the UCP does have a majority in the Alberta legislature. I'm wondering where that leaves you. If you have such issues with this bill, where does that leave you to fight if they can pass this through the ledge so easily?
Well, they'll be able to pass it without a problem. So where does it leave us? I guess it leaves us in a place where after they pass it, we'll find out what it actually means. We'll find out what the regulations are. We'll find out what the definitions are. Hopefully there will be some sort of consultation process, but you know, if it comes after it's passed, that doesn't help us very much. So municipalities right now are at the whim of the province. Not only have they reintroduced big money into elections, they're now saying that corporations and unions can contribute directly to candidates. Then they're saying, but if we don't like what happened, we can remove people. So now you got big money and you have overreach at the municipal level, and it makes no sense to me why they would do this.
Mayor Gondek, will continue to follow where this goes, and hopefully we'll speak again in future, but for this evening, thank you very much.
Thank you. Have a great night.
You too. Well, to the budget now, as 2 weeks on and the ideas outlined in the Liberal plan seem to be failing to catch any fire, Liberal numbers are still mired in the low 20s, despite the government's attempt to secure the youth vote with their promise to make the economy more fair for every generation, and despite the government's promises to make life affordable for everyone with their focus on housing. Here is the latest analysis from 338 Canada. Based on available polls, 338 says conservatives are at 42% support. The Liberals are at 24%. New Democrats sit at 18%. The Bloc are at 8%, and the Greens are at 4%. Well, for more, polls analyst Philippe Fournier joins us right now. He's the editor-in-chief of 338 Canada. Philippe, good to see you. Thank you for being here.
Good evening, Michael.
Now, as I said, the budget seems to be failing to catch any fire. Talk to us about what Canadians are actually saying about the Liberal plan.
Well, here's the problem with the Liberal plan, because Canadians are not saying much about it. Even though there was a rollout for 2 to 3 weeks prior to the budget, the numbers barely have moved. I follow the numbers on a daily and weekly basis. And at the start of April, we had the Conservatives with a lead of about 15 to 17 points. Now it's 18 points. So not only did the trend did not reverse itself, it seems to be even accentuated. And so, of course, it's a bit early to see the direct effect of the budget in the electorate, but so far it's not a good news for the Trudeau team, for sure.
Okay, not good news, and from the numbers I see, not even amongst the Gen Z and millennials they are trying to target. So from what you have seen or shared there, it might not surprise the government, because apparently Justin Trudeau did tell his team that Liberal numbers would not improve until sometime next year if the interest rates are down and if people are feeling better with their bank accounts. You know, I'm wondering, when you look historically at polls, is that enough to pull the Liberals out of this 16-point deficit behind Conservatives?
Well, the state of the economy, it is no surprise that it often is correlated with the state of a government. However, this aging government, 9 years in, close to a decade with this Liberal government, and the economy is in a bad shape. Inflation is still high, even though it's coming back down, but the effects are still being felt by many Canadians. When you promise that perhaps the interest rate, which the government doesn't control, will come down and that will help our numbers, this could be a bit of wishful thinking. It's not just a few months trend. Now we're almost 1 year into this this lead for the Conservatives, this double-digit lead that is spread throughout the country. And that's another problem for the Liberals. It's not just one region or two. It's basically everywhere. And even in Quebec, where the Liberals have fared well in past years, now they're in the mid-20s at best.
Okay, now you call it wishful thinking, perhaps wishful thinking. But, you know, the Liberal argument also hinges on this idea that Canadians may be tired of Trudeau, but they don't necessarily love Pierre Poilievre. Does that still hold true, though? You know, Pierre Poilievre has gone through this image overhaul. His party has been running these ads. Is Pierre Poilievre becoming a better selling point for his party?
Well, he has for sure managed to coalesce his party behind him, which is something that Mr. O'Toole, for instance, never could do during his reign as a Conservative leader. When we look at the numbers, we see right now the Conservatives do have their coalition, their winning coalition for a government win next year. And so, I mean, in hockey terms, you could say the Conservatives could play the trap. They have their winning coalition. They can just wait it out and see what's going on in the heads of Liberals for the next year, but they don't need to win over new voters. They're at 40, 42, 43% nationally, according to the polls. That's enough for a win, especially with a very unpopular prime minister and an NDP that's going nowhere, basically.
Okay, well, you say the NDP, and I also want to ask you about that party, because as we know, the Liberals and the New Democrats, they do have this supply and confidence agreement. Despite that, we see the NDP leader not giving immediate thumbs up to the budget. You know, why is Mr. Singh doing that? When you look at the numbers, why is he publicly so hesitant about this budget?
That is a very good question, Michael. I must say I am very careful to not tread on other people's terrain. I'm a polls guy, and when I look at the numbers, I see absolutely no leverage for the NDP. The NDP, half of their caucus is in British Columbia. And the latest polls that we saw out of BC, the federal polls that we see out of BC, the Conservatives could win as much as 45 or 50% of the vote, which would decimate the NDP caucus. And to compensate for those projected loss in British Columbia, there's no sign in the prairies, in Ontario, in Atlantic Canada, or in Quebec, that the NDP could recover. And so this strategy from Mr. Singh, I'm guessing it's like bluffing at poker, but electorally, if you look at a purely numbered stance, there's no way that the NDP could gain anything out of that. But we'll see what they decide to do.
Yeah, I'm wondering if it will actually hurt his image to kind of be playing this card time and again.
It's possible. The Mr. Singh's numbers have taken a hit in recent months, but they're still lukewarm, I would say. Mr. Singh has favorables and unfavorables that are relatively at the same level, but also he's not judged at the same level as Mr. Trudeau or Mr. Poilievre. Sometimes a third party leader will have good numbers because he or she is not a threat to the status quo. There's no indication that there's an orange wave coming with Mr. Singh in the numbers that we see right now.
Okay. Well, Philippe, always appreciate the conversation. Thank you for that.
Thank you very much, Michael.
And that's Philippe Fournier. And that is our program for you on this Monday. For everyone here at CPAC, thank you for watching. I'm Michael Serapio, Primetime Politics. We'll be back tomorrow night. We'll see you then.